Hey everyone, just a reminder that we are recording remotely while we're quarantined, so the sound might be slightly compromised, but hopefully not too bad. Enjoy!
Welcome to Feminists Without Mystique, a podcast where we process politics, sex, and the unrelenting fire hose of bullshit in the news. Bullshit in the news through an unapologetically feminist lens. Each week we vent about the news, go deep on one important issue, call out terrible things happening below the top headlines in a segment called We See You, and then we'll end with something hopeful. Hello, everyone. I hope you're ready for the bullshit ride.
Happy Tuesday. Another week in pandemic paradise. Primary paradise. Ooh, alliteration.
Ooh, look at you. It continues to be a wild and crazy times in this wild world. Beautiful outside. Not that I'm out there much, but...
but it was... It's beautiful.
It's great. So yeah, you had a great segue there. Primary. I want to talk about Kentucky.
Yeah.
Where I don't know if you guys know this, Mitch McConnell. We don't like him.
We don't like him.
He's the Senate Majority Leader. He's been there since 1985. He's way too powerful. And so it's like for a while, Amy McGrath was going to be like running against him. But now there's another Democratic challenger, Charles Booker.
Mm-hmm.
He's been shaken up, and he is a person of color. So I don't know. I haven't done enough research on, because before I was just like, all right, Amy McGrath, yep. But now with someone new in the mix, I am going to have to do a little more research on him. But he seems pretty cool.
Yeah, he does seem cool.
Seems very qualified.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems really qualified. He's really spiked in the polls with the sort of reinvigoration of the Black Lives Matter movement, because he's from one of the poorest, maybe the poorest county in Kentucky. And he sort of has been marching in the streets in Louisville and been like very, very visible. And and he also like, he seems like a great candidate in that he has been, his speeches have been inspiring. They're heartfelt. They're very like, feels very connected to like the moment. And he has like a whole thing about like, he calls it the hood to the holler. Like just about kind of the people that he speaks to, which seems like a succinct, like kind of excellent tagline for Kentucky. And he's also gotten a lot of like prominent endorsements from Bernie Sanders and AOC and Elizabeth Warren. And so he seems like he's giving Amy McGrath a run for her money. And I'm like, as with all of these primaries, like, I feel like it's a little bit of like trigger warning from like the Democratic presidential primaries of 2020, because it comes down to like, I mean, ultimately above all else, kind of like with Trump, we need to beat Mitch McConnell. We need to beat him.
Yeah.
And there is a powerful, understandable argument that Booker would be actually a better candidate, because instead of like moving to the middle, like moderate, if everyone just like, it would just be Mitch McConnell versus Booker, and he would be like new and invigorating and a real progressive, and that might move people, because he's, but the more I was reading too, like, and actually not but, but the more I was reading about Amy McGrath, I was sort of like, oh God, like, just reminded me how, while she's an appealing candidate to possibly win Kentucky because she's a moderate and she can just pick off like quote unquote reasonable moderate people, she's not a great candidate. She has botched a couple of like kind of important moments recently. Like she really kind of flubbed an answer on the pandemic or on Black Lives Matter. And like someone asked her like, what have you been doing? Have you protested? Have you been, where have you been? Kind of, what are your thoughts? And she's like, she sort of was like, no, I long and short of it, no, she hasn't been protesting. And she didn't even like really say anything supportive of the movement. She was like, we're in the middle of a pandemic and I had family stuff going on this weekend. It's like, you have had a, you are a congressional candidate. You should be prepared for that question and you should knock it out of the park. Like, and it really doesn't, to me, I don't think it would take that much political acumen to understand, like, to have a better answer ready. So that was gross. I also didn't realize, or maybe I did and I forgot because I shoved it out of my mind, that last year she said that she would have voted to support Justice Kavanaugh. And I was, and then she walked it back because everyone freaked out, but it's like, but you still said it though.
Yeah, you had to walk it back.
Or just faced with one of those like weird decisions.
Okay, Mr. Booker, I'll check you out. Maybe I'll give you some money. Because I did donate to Amy McGrath back in the day.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, Mitch McConnell needs to get the fuck out of there. But
yeah.
You know.
Well, you'll know whether or not you need to donate to Booker by the end of, well, actually probably not by tonight. Right now, it looks like she's ahead by maybe a 10% margin, but there's still, we still need about 50%, including the bigger counties, to report. And with all the absentee voting, it seems like we probably won't know tonight.
Yeah.
But it's one to watch for sure. And one other one, New York, there's a few like interesting cases, but one of the more interesting ones, and more interesting by interesting, I just mean like important, is the Democratic primary in New York's 16th district, which is
Bowman.
So looks like, well, there's only 1% reporting, so we really can't like make any actual judgments, but he's ahead, but that doesn't really matter. But Elliot Engel is sort of like a really conservative Democrat, and he's made a couple of interesting, I just learned about this today when I was sort of like, okay, who is this fucker? He was caught on mic recently, basically like trying to speak about Black Lives Matter. And someone was like, he basically said, if I wasn't in a, if I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care. And then they were like, say that again. He was like, if I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care.
Wow. Well, so, I gotta appreciate the honesty, right?
I mean, I think what I think from context, because I was like, did he really though? Like, I think from context, he, this is, doesn't make it better, but it, he basically meant like, I wouldn't be angling to speak. I wouldn't be so eager to like get in front of the mic. But I still feel like it's pretty sinister and gross.
It's not a good it's not a good look regardless, you know. And it's like, and Jamal Bowman has like, you know, AOC backing him up, and it's like a teacher, just like an all around, and like a true progressive, a true progressive,
a true one.
So it should be, you know, it should be interesting to kind of see how this plays out.
Fingers crossed. And it's another shitty situation where we have to watch like the really stodgy, uninspiring moderates in the party, like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, although she keeps saying she's progressive. They backed Elliot Engel, and then Hillary backed him too. Like in her first 2020 primary endorsement, she like went for him first.
Well, she was never wildly progressive. Well, she was in a sense in certain periods of time, but you know. But,
yeah.
2020, like, she's, you know, a little more moderate than some.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's always disappointing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a quick look at the primaries from today. Everyone should.
We'll see. Maybe we'll have more to talk about with them, or maybe we'll just have to forget.
Maybe we'll just have to eat it and move on with the moderates, which, you know, we will do if we have to, but here's hoping.
Yeah. Speaking of hope and opposites, you had a little something penned out about Barr and Berman. You had
I mean, William Barr is one of, and again, like Mitch McConnell holds the title for me for like most loathsome human being on the planet.
Oh yeah.
Firmly he holds that title. But he's constantly, there are lots of other like wrinkly, ignorant, or not even ignorant, because I guess Barr is smart, but like these like just abhorrent men that keep vying for the title of like worst person in the world. And yeah. Barr is definitely like right there, right below Mitch. And basically, so we learned once again that he's basically like acting as an arm of, he's basically Trump's Department of Justice. He is not like the Department of Justice, like trying to act on behalf of the American people. He, all he's done is obstruct on behalf of Trump. And in the most recent case, he, on Friday around 9 p.m. like Eastern, he basically said that the president was going to nominate the former head of the SEC as the new attorney general of the Southern District of New York, and said that Jeff Berman would be stepping down. And this was just like a 9 p.m. press release from Barr. And then there was nothing from the AG, Jeff Berman. And then later around 11 p.m. on Friday, he released a statement saying he was not stepping down, hadn't heard anything about this transition, and wouldn't step down until like the Senate confirmed a new AG, unless he heard from Trump, or unless Trump fired him. And then on Saturday, like at the end of the day, Barr released a statement saying that Trump did fire him, and it's like a shame that that he had to play this like public, you know, this public politics game and like the theater of the absurd. You know, he used some sort of like really shitty language. And so Jeff Berman said, okay, I will step down. And then the concession, quote unquote, that Barr made was to have Jeff Berman's deputy AG take over for him instead of this guy from the SEC who has like no litigation experience. So it was like, right. Yeah. So it seemed like, oh, like it's a quote unquote concession, but I guess, you know, listening to Preet Bharara talk about it, another former AG of the Southern District who Trump fired, ugh, what a club. he said that this actually was significant because Berman, who, by the way, was a Trump appointee and like gave money, you know, even though he was in like, obviously he was acting independently enough of Trump that it really pissed Trump off. Like he was investigating Giuliani and his associates and some of Trump's like different businesses and lots of stuff. So it's unclear exactly why they made this move to fire Berman, but he was a Trump person, a Trump appointee, a Republican donor. He is not like a hero of the resistance. So, but at least he feels more comfortable stepping down, it seems, because his deputy will be in charge as opposed to some other fucking rando. But this is all just your like literal, should be a daily reminder that William Barr actually is he's such a bad actor. He's incredibly corrupt. He keeps bucking the traditions of like the intelligence community blatantly. I mean, like, remember when he said like history was written by the winners, like smirkingly last month? It's just
such a creeper. And it's like the gall to fire a federal prosecutor like less than 6 months from an election when there was like, and just like assume, well, we can get away with whatever, you know? It's just such a blatantly fucked up move.
Yeah.
They're just like feeling invincible, it feels like.
They are. I mean, I think like Ben Rhodes or someone from the Obama administration tweeted something about like, our nation is far further down the path of autocratic rule than we have the capacity to really wrap our brains around. And I do think that like, imagine what happens if Trump wins in November, like if they have the gall to be repeatedly obstructing justice again and again, because no Susan Collins, like Trump did not learn his lesson. If they keep doing this, if he has four more years and no chance to get real or like no one that he needs to impress, I really, really, that makes me incredibly fearful for democracy, which feels like it's hanging by a thread right now.
Yeah, it makes me real anxious.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
What happens next in this circus?
Yeah. Great. But,
so next on the docket, COVID. just all the greatest hits right now.
Yeah, moving towards something a little lighter.
Yes, the pandemic. Yeah, spikes are happening in a lot of states in this country. And the connection seems to be the places where bars and restaurants and like other like indoor places where people gather are reopening. And it doesn't look like outdoor protests are causing much of a spike, which bodes well because that tells you, you know, if you're outdoors and wearing a mask, like you can, you know, not rely on it, but it's somewhat effective at least, pretty damn effective. So that's good. But, you know, and there's also, I mean, it's worth noting that more people have access to testing overall than did before. So there is something to be said for, you know, there being more cases before than we knew about. But, you know, it's like you look at the places that are having the big spikes, like certain places in Texas and Florida and these other places where people have been like very publicly gathering right next to each other in bars or, you know, on the beaches or wherever. And it's a lot of, it's mostly young people where the spike is, which I think is just kind of people deciding that the pandemic's over, you know?
Yeah. And,
just being like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm probably not going to die from it, whatever. It's a bummer.
It is a bummer. And it's also, you know, it's, the data is clear, you know, when we're looking at where the cases are increasing and how quickly. And Texas is really scary right now. Oh, yeah. I mean, the spikes in Texas and Florida specifically are really worrying. From the last 14 days, the it looks like a exponential increase. And we're heading into, like you say, a summer where we're all going to have to be defining our own boundaries personally. And it's really, I think it puts, I mean, it puts an emotional, a physical, a social strain on everyone. We're trying to make these very serious, very conscientious and calculated decisions about what our risk is and how to navigate. And like I was talking to, I think probably my naturopath, and she was sort of impressing upon me like the importance of basically figuring out, like, you take in the information and make your decision about what your boundaries are and then stick to those boundaries. And
yeah,
I find that that in itself, it's a very simple thing, but it's already becoming incredibly challenging. Like, and I just want to point out, like, I feel like there, this is definitely one of those moments where my brain has like 17 different points to make, but, I think what's been one of the more depressing things that I've maps that I've seen is an overlay of the US's coronavirus cases and the cases in places like Spain and Italy and the UK, like where they have dipped. It's not just flattening the curve. They are really like, they have driven their cases down to a place where it looks like they'll be safe to reopen. You can't just, it just exposes like all the flaws in the US healthcare system and, and in our like individualistic like ethos where we're all like, you can't tell me what to do, freedom, you know, and like, it's summer. So like, isn't this over? And it's just all this, but because there's a huge vacuum in leadership, we, none of us can agree on anything. And that is why we're going to be stuck in this like hellish loop that might get worse in the fall. It's very frustrating.
It is. And it's like, when you look at, when you compare to other countries, like you said, like, yeah, most of them are doing way better than us. The only place that has a similar chart to ours is fucking Russia.
Great.
Which is like a fun little parallel we can all ponder. what is your, what have you decided are your COVID rules for yourself?
Well, I have had a hard time kind of figuring out something super consistent. I think the easiest things that I've at least decided for just for me is like some of the more obvious things, like I won't be traveling via plane anytime soon. I'm not going to go into a restaurant or like an enclosed space with a lot of people. I'll still protest with a mask. I'm going to try not to use Ubers if I can. And like, I haven't used one since like February. And that's also because I'm lucky. My boyfriend has a car. So it's not like I have abstained from Uber. Thankfully, like someone can drive me. And I mean, we were just talking before the pod. I think that it's like this is like a perfect and also super painful one. It's like your wedding is coming up.
it's tricky. And so we're moving, for those who don't know, we're moving our reception, like the full 150 people, whatever, to next summer. But we're having like a small backyard ceremony, and we're just like trying to figure out the best way to, because we have more than enough space for people to distance from each other, you know, and people wear like masks during the ceremony and all that. But, you know, then it's like, okay, but if we want to feed people, how do we do it? Because we can't do buffet style. That's madness, you know? And so it's like, okay, like have individually wrapped, you know, meals that we get from like the catering or whatever. And give everyone a hand sanitizer and like cut it off at a certain time so people don't get drunk and like start ignoring the rules and, you know, but it's hard to figure out. And we also don't know what the world's going to look like in, you know, 3 weeks or whatever. So, you know, just trying to figure out a way that kind of is responsible and like honors what we want to do, but also we're going to be isolating for 2 weeks after in a cabin, you know? And I'm going to get the results of a COVID antibody test soon, which of course we don't know how long it gives you immunity, or technically we don't know if it does, but I mean, with how viruses work, I'd be shocked. But it's hard to kind of figure out how to balance those. Cause it's like, I've pretty much just not gone anywhere this whole time, but you know, with this like life event, how to manage it in a safe and responsible way, you know? So we'll see. Pondering.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a very strong part of me that's like so excited to see a couple of the people that are flying in, and the desire to want to not wear a mask while hanging out with them the night before, you know, I think that's going to be kind of the big cue, at least for me, is like,
that's
what whether or not.
Cause the thing about the masks is, and I always wear it when I'm interacting with someone closer than 6 feet, but it does take something away from the social interaction. You know, it's like, it's hard not being able to see someone's like full facial expressions and all that. But I mean, still everyone needs to wear their masks. It's just, it's one of the parts of it that kind of sucks a little bit, but totally worth it.
Yeah. Oh, definitely worth it.
Just kind of a bumski.
And would be much easier for everyone to navigate if there was leadership that was at least we knew, we would know why or how long, or more of a direction. More purpose. Instead, it's like we are all making our own fucking individual decisions. Yeah. We've all become epidemiologists. Like,
I'm thankful we have a good leadership in our state, at least. But you know,
yes,
Jay Inslee's making it a crime to not be wearing a mask, a misdemeanor, starting on Friday. If in all like public spaces where you can't socially distance, you have to wear a mask. So, and they actually already in the apartment building, my dad's where I'm staying right now, they printed out and put under everyone's door already, like information about how everyone in the building when they're in common areas needs to wear a mask starting Friday. And which is good. I'm glad it's happening. You don't need to wear a mask if you're at the White House, but we'll get into that later.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It's a little COVID, I guess, lowlights, not really highlights.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's one thing that I hadn't thought about, but that I had read about. There, like, now that there are a lot of places that are kind of easing up on the evictions protections for people, they're having a lot of these sort of court meetings over Zoom. And if you can't get on Zoom because you don't have a smartphone or a computer, you automatically lose the case and you're evicted.
What?
So it's just like, yeah, because you're not showing up.
No.
Which is like not going to, that's not going to hold up for long, because that's not like it's denying you some like legal rights there. Yeah, that's happening.
Oh my God. Also, if you are in jeopardy of being evicted, I can't imagine that you might not have easy access to the best Wi-Fi or technology or a Zoom account. It's like,
yeah,
even if you're doing it, like, oh my God.
It's like overdraft fees, you know? It's just like, okay.
Yeah, kick people when they're down.
Punishing people for being poor at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like never something you can get out from under.
Yeah. Ugh. And of course there are like huge racial disparities with COVID-19. There have been a lot of kind of studies on racial disparities in healthcare in general. And there have been kind of more and more coming out showing the disparities with COVID-19. And there's a relatively new one that came out showing that Black Americans enrolled in Medicare were hospitalized nearly 4 times more than their white counterparts. Mm. And Hispanics were more than twice as likely to be, or Latinx, hospitalized as white, and Asian Americans about 50% more likely. And, you know, part of this is because frontline workers are disproportionately people of color when compared to the general population, you know. And of course, because of like systemic racism and all of the things, you know, they're less likely to have access to like good healthcare resources and, you know, community resources that could help with this kind of stuff. So
yeah.
It's real shitty.
It's really shitty. It's really, you know, the fact, like, I see some conservative perspectives, or I see that when conservative perspectives seem to basically get fed up with trying to comprehend COVID or trying to comprehend the Black Lives Matter movement. And, like, I think to people who are conservative listening to this, it's like, what I would say is maybe just to try to push back on that impulse to shut it out, because the enormity of what we're talking about, the enormity of these crises and the scale, like the historic scale, the just entrenched roots of these issues, can be so overwhelming. And to really explore these issues might lead to a lot of like self-reckoning and having to really come to terms with like a toppling of a certain worldview, because, and that is complicated, I'm sure, to wrestle with and to just have to kind of acknowledge that things are not as simple as we wish they could be.
Yeah.
I think a lot of like conservative branding and perspectives rely on like dichotomies and like simple positioning of like one side versus the other, or like a simple truth, like a simple thing that people want to be true. Like in the 90s, the perspective of like, I don't see color, you know, that's like, okay, something that you can just say to dismiss issues. And of course you do. So it's like, it's a lie, but like, it's also an infuriating whatever. Anyway, it's sort of like, I think as much as you can to sort of just like notice the resistance in your brain, in your body, in your soul to these rumblings, and then just try to absorb them a little and deep breaths, just push past it, because we need you to. It's important.
Yeah, it is. And hopefully, you know, with trying, because they need to, you know, also train, you know, healthcare providers better on their biases, you know. But I think mostly what we need to do is provide, you know, social services to people in communities, you know, and create safety nets and invest in communities, even if they're not the ones that have been gerrymandered to be all white people. So, you know,
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
And then we wanted to speak to CHOP, formerly known as Chaz. Briefly. We talked about it last week. It's continuing to be overall a seemingly safe place. There was one reported sexual assault that was stopped by someone there before it escalated. And then there have been two shootings, but that area is currently, I looked at the data and the graph, in that area of Seattle, it's still on sort of where it's been historically in various years in the last 5 years in terms of number of shootings. And of course, you remember there was someone shot during the protests while police were there. And what I wanted to clear up, I guess, about the shooting aspect of it, because there's lots of like sort of speculation about what was happening. But in the first shooting, a 19-year-old black man died. There was this dispute on like Twitter and everywhere about what went on with like the police and the protesters, and the police said that violent protesters were preventing them from getting in and so apparently what happened was that the fire department did get there quickly but they wouldn't go in because they didn't feel safe without the police there. So, and the police took an incredibly long time to get there, and you can, on the police scanner, they were having disagreements on where to meet and to build up forces, and were just kind of taking their time with it. And so no one blocked them from entering the area, but they ended up having to eventually the medics transport the two people who were shot themselves because the cops just didn't get there in time. And it's still, you know, largely peaceful. There's, you know, art and community events and, you know, a free co-op and, you know, people are feeding the homeless and all that. So it's, you know, people see any reports of violence out of there, and it's kind of like, gotcha. See, it's this awful, like, you know, and it's like, no, there's nuance to situations. You know, it's, there have been some instances there, but also in that area, you know, I've seen people be sexually assaulted before CHOP, you know, in Capitol Hill. The presence of, you know, there was a woman stabbed to death last summer while the police were there. It's the police, and the police presence doesn't necessarily actually reduce crime. It's a little complicated, but it's also not very complicated.
I think that's well said. Yeah, there's sort of a frustration for sure that like also a lot of these provocateurs and the real like violence that has been happening has been from the far right, from Proud Boys and Boogaloos, and like
there have been like calls on social media for people to go in and like shoot the protesters. And also worth noting that Mayor Jenny Durkin of Seattle is saying that it needs to close. CHOP needs to close. So we'll see how that goes, because the protesters' demands have not been met yet, which was, there are three of them. You know, it's reducing the police budget by 50%, and just two others that I'm blanking on right now. Let's see.
I'm forgetting too.
Protesters' requests, but they also want Durkin to resign, but that's not one of their official requests.
God, she's what a disappointment she's been.
I mean, I didn't vote for her. But it's been, she's been a little bit depressing to watch, because she is a queer woman, and it's like, God, do better, man.
She was not the one that the stranger endorsed, right?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I voted for whoever. I don't remember who that person was, but anyway, no, that's a side note. Yeah, so that's the update on CHOP, and the kind of, it's a perfect encapsulation of, I think, like, the mixed bag that is those types of occupied spaces and spaces for protest, and the way that sometimes like bad actors can exploit them. But yeah, we'll just have to see what happens there.
Indeed. And you know, the protests are going to continue. So
yeah,
hopefully they don't use tear gas like they've kind of been alluding to, saying that if they'd used tear gas, that person would have been alive, which, like,
wow.
No, not how it works.
Wow. Yeah. And before we even, like, before we move to other things too, I mean, like you say, because the protests are very much still happening. There are lots of actions that we can and should be taking to push this movement forward. And I think this was news that happened in the last week after we taped, but there's still been no justice for Breonna Taylor. It's been 122 days, I think, at this point since she was murdered in her bed. One of the officers has been fired. And this, I just think, is worth pointing out because I found it disgusting. The Louisville PD terminated Detective Brett Hankinson for displaying, quote, an extreme indifference to the value of human life. His termination letter states that he, quote, wantonly and blindly fired 10 rounds into Breonna Taylor's apartment. An extreme indifference to the value of human life shouldn't be something that is only grounds for termination. Yeah. Like, especially from a law enforcement office.
Yeah.
Anyone that displays an extreme indifference towards the value of human life, which is a wild euphemism for murder, needs to be prosecuted. And it is the fact that there's this much pressure in Louisville and there's only been one of the three officers has been fired and, like, nothing else has happened is just worth bringing up, because if you're someone who thinks that, like, the protests have moved things substantially, there's a lot of good evidence that things are moving, but this is one of the fucking primary focal points and nothing has moved. So just want to kind of stick that in there.
Yeah.
So one thing that we wanted to talk about that kind of ties into, I think, this broader conversation of white women complicity that we talked about last week, and just I saw it today and it kind of felt like it put its finger on something that I think white women need to wrestle with, is kind of this corporate feminism, the exploitation of kind of the concept of feminism and female empowerment as a way to make money and as a sort of an exclusionary space. And ultimately, what's kind of painful is that at the hands of these certain women, these spaces, these like female-centric corporate girl boss vibes end up really excluding people and being ultimately pretty hollow and hypocritical in spouting their version of feminism.
Yeah, I appreciated, and the point really resonated with me when she makes the point about how everything with kind of like the girl boss movement is framed around, like, how can I make the system work better for me versus who is a system designed to work for? I thought that was a really good point. It's because it almost feels like, you know, with the Sandbergs, the old Sandberg stuff and all that, like just trying to act like one of the, you know, the white guys. And there's one quote I pulled that I really liked from it, that I really liked, that I thought It was great. The white girl boss, and so many of them were white, sat at the unique intersection of oppression and privilege. She saw gender inequity everywhere she looked. This gave her something to wage war against. Racial inequity was never really on her radar. That was someone else's problem to solve.
Yes.
You know, and I feel like that too. Like white woman feminism, like, perfectly encapsulated there. You know, it's just like, well, yeah, racism is wrong, but like, I'm going to do this.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's those same women who say that they don't, you know, they're not racist and they believe in equality, but then they move into like the area that's 99% white in their town, you know?
Yeah.
Those kinds of things. So it's, and I think that it's been late, but I think that I'm optimistic that this sort of chapter of the Black Lives Matter civil rights movement is kind of awakening and mobilizing a lot of, hopefully, a lot of women who were kind of cared, but not enough to do anything, kind of complacent before. And understanding that, like, your role as a feminist is to be an intersectional feminist, you know, and feminism doesn't begin and end with, like, white, liberal, college-educated women. So I liked that. It's like, you know, all these, there are these, you know, brands that like to come across as woke, but maybe aren't necessarily putting in any work towards diversity in any real way, you know.
Yeah. And there's sort of that insidious concept of like knowing that you should be like gesturing to, you know enough to know that you should be focusing on diversity, but instead you only focus on the appearance of diversity. And how I think and Robin DiAngelo gets at this at one point in her book about like basically just like the system actually becomes even more deeply entrenched in that way because it's just a new generation of carefully kind of weaving this like white supremacist basically like ideology, just finding whatever that next level is to make it kind of socially acceptable and to avoid actually speaking about the real problems. And it's another way to deny the importance of talking about race, because it's just so uncomfortable and none of us have really like learned how to do it without, I don't know, exposing this like vulnerable part of ourselves. I feel like talking about it, at least for me, I feel like it's an uncomfortable thing because it feels taboo. It still feels sort of weird and like
it's like when you're raised it's like I feel like a lot of kids were taught like you're supposed to act like you're colorblind, you know. Which of course we've talked about, saying you're colorblind or whatever just ignores disparities and that allows them to, you know, continue forever. So the solution is not to pretend you don't see race, to address the issues in our society that are at the heart of systemic racism, you know?
Yeah. It's, and I think like, I certainly want to be on the lookout for different feminist quote unquote organizations or groups that, take the language of female empowerment and then, are not being intersectional, you know, we're not being conscious of making sure that everyone's perspectives are being considered. And this was an issue, I think, with the leaders of the Women's March, which is sad. Like this break, you know, it's painful to kind of see that, like Pantsuit Nation or whatever that Facebook group before I got off of Facebook, I remember like just there being like sometimes clashes between like, between people and between kind of like, I think, white women maybe latching onto again, it's like feels like kind of an easy quote unquote sensible rhetorical argument, which is to say like, let's just focus on like female equality point blank and like without trying to get into, let's not quote unquote complicate it with like race stuff, you know, the race factor. And that's I think a tempting sort of way to feel it. It's a tempting route for people to feel like they can intellectually go down and be like, yeah, let's do that. Let's focus on like poverty point blank, feminism like equal rights for all. There we go. And it's sort of, it just doesn't, it can't work that way. It shouldn't work that way. And this is just an acknowledgement. I mean, I thought this article, while it didn't, was just sort of another interesting piece of that, girl boss, feminism as a failure, you know, feminism's failure to be truly intersectional. And it was, if you're interested, the article itself is called "The End of Girl Boss Is Here," and written by Leigh Stein, and it's on Medium.
Yes, check it out.
Check it out.
All right.
Yeah. And now for We See You.
For some reason, it always has to be you. It's the habit.
I know.
I'm used to it. All righty. So I, and probably lots of people, have been seeing conservative people on social media just chomping at the bit to post videos and images of Black people saying all lives matter, or Black people talking about Black on Black crime. It's this weird thing where, like, if you respond with why it's important to say Black Lives Matter, they can just say, but look at this Black person saying something else. You're saying, as a white person, you know better than a Black person about race, you know. But the majority of Black Americans, and in fact the majority of all Americans, do actually support the Black Lives Matter movement and message. And even if individual Black Americans say they don't support it, with the history and the present racism in this country, white people don't get to disagree with any movement that is affirming the value of Black lives. And as I've mentioned, but it cannot be said enough, bringing up Black on Black crime never adds value to a conversation. White on white crime is not talked about, but it's just as much of a thing. Like I've said, Black people tend to live around Black people, and white people tend to live around white people, and people who are killed tend to be killed near where they live. If we want to reduce violent crime overall, we should invest in public social services. And in regards to the right-wing people posting these things, as if to say, see, look, I'm right. Look at this Black person agreeing with me. Joshua Pease put it perfectly when he said, if you're a white person who thinks all this racism talk is getting out of hand and you're quick to post the video of a famous Black person agreeing with you, but won't read a book from a Black person in their field disagreeing with you, then you aren't trying to learn. You're just weaponizing Black voices to confirm your own bias.
Mm-hmm.
Puts it perfectly.
Yeah.
So to those people, we see you.
We see you. Kentucky. We spoke about it briefly at the top of the episode. Today, Tuesday, June 23rd, Democratic primaries are being held in New York, Kentucky, and Virginia. It's a depressing shit show for a number of reasons. So one could be forgiving for glancing at the headlines and immediately just wanting to take an Advil and a nap. There are long, long lines, there were today, and active voter suppression. Most egregiously in Kentucky, where my least favorite quote-unquote human, Mitch McConnell, has used the global pandemic as an excuse to even further restrict voting by reducing the number of polling places statewide by 95%. 95%. Kentucky has reduced the number of polling places from 3,700 to just 170. So stop and think about this. Jefferson County, the largest county and the county that has half of the state's Black population, a county with over 600,000 registered voters, has been reduced to only one polling location today. One polling location for 600,000 registered voters. Cliff Albright, the co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter, says that there is potential for record turnout despite these flagrant, disgusting voter suppression tactics. Apparently, 200,000 Kentuckians requested absentee ballots, and people are energized, especially since Louisville was the site of Breonna Taylor's murder. Another aside, it's been 102 days, and there still have been no arrests of the officers responsible for murder. 102 days, and the most we've eked out is that one of the officers has been fired. So the voters in Kentucky are ready to be heard. but will their ballots actually count? States are fighting mail-in ballot policies to help avoid a case like Wisconsin, where people had to, or states are fighting the mail-in ballot policies. But we want to avoid a situation like Wisconsin where people had to vote in person in the middle of a pandemic, or a situation like Georgia where people had to vote in person at places like nursing homes. So even
good Lord,
I know there's a really depressing article about that in the New York Times. It's like, so even when we are able to fight all of the bullshit bureaucracy and get mail-in voting up and running, there are many ways for administrative malfeasance, aka voter suppression, to occur. Arguably, there are actually more opportunities than in-person voting, which is super depressing, but just think about these issues. The issues over who gets sent ballots and how do you qualify to use a mail-in ballot? Like, does everyone get one? Can you request one? Who can request one? For the ballot itself, does it have to be received by the date of the election, or can it be posted by the date of the election? The signatures on the ballots, do they match? Some voters don't, you might have to sign in two places, and if the voter isn't aware of that, then the ballots that aren't signed in both places wouldn't be counted. There's also the issue of the matching signatures. So in Kentucky, your signature has to match your license, the signature on your license, which if like for a lot of people, I don't know what my signature on my license actually looks like or like, and if it was matched, I mean, I just do a scribble. So like it could be very likely and you would never know that your vote actually wasn't being counted. I think in some instances, like I know New York State would send people like months later, you would get a piece of paper that's like, by the way, your vote didn't count. And that actually happened to a friend of ours, but, so while mail-in ballots are important, it's also important to think about all the ways that you can get administratively fucked by that also. So, and then this is all against the backdrop of a not only scary, but disastrously managed global pandemic that we've spoken about, in which Trump just tweets whatever the fuck he wants. And in this case, he's pulled out his old playbook and is casting doubt on the whole process of voting, calling foul play while his goons are the ones rigging the game. In a recent tweet, he blustered, quote, because of all caps, mail-in ballots, 2020 will be the most rigged election in our nation's history. Super cool, very chill. It's all a fucking nightmare. And Kentucky is just the most recent state we're looking at because their primary happens to be today. There's a lot in this rant, but the most upsetting and unacceptable thing is that there's a 95% reduction in access to polling stations for this primary. One polling place for the 600,000 registered voters of Jefferson County. This should give Chief Justice Roberts yet another reason to feel like a world-class dum-dum, since he and his conservatives gutted the Voting Rights Act a few years ago, and they said that such stringent federal protections on voting weren't needed anymore. Lol, you fool. As RBG said in her dissent in that voting rights case a few years ago, quote, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. It's raining, it's pouring, and Kentuckians deserve free and fair elections. We see you.
Yes. All right. DC is entering phase two of reopening and the White House is scaling back COVID screening for everyone entering the building, unless you're going to be in close proximity to Trump. Prior to this, they had tents stationed along the north entrance where they performed temperature checks and COVID risk questionnaires. Face coverings have been and remain voluntary. It's also worth noting that a few days ago, six of Trump's campaign staffers tested positive, and as we've mentioned, cases are on the rise. Granted, temperature screenings paired with questionnaires isn't the most effective way to prevent transmission, but it's definitely better than nothing. But now those things are disappearing unless you'll be next to Trump. So they clearly see the benefit to these practices if they're keeping them in place to protect the super worthy of protecting Donald Trump. It's just ridiculous. The hypocrisy out of the White House and Trump regarding COVID-19. He acts as if it's no big deal, but makes rally attendees sign a waiver. Everything's beautiful pandemic-wise, but if you're going to be near him, you should probably get screened first. He will continue to act like there's no problem at all as Americans continue to die at climbing rates. His complete ineptitude is really showing, but it's not like it was ever too hidden in the first place. We see you, you buffoon.
You buffoon. This article is like super disconcerting. I saw it in New York Times today, but it was from a few days ago. Again, just sort of one of those things that you glance at and then you're like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. So the article is Many Medical Decision Tools Disadvantage Black Patients. And there's a new paper that talks about digital calculators that doctors refer to make treatment decisions that can end up denying Black patients access to certain specialists, drugs, and transplants, just based on essentially like a calculator that makes adjustments based on their race and no other factor, which is wild to me and seems completely anti-scientific. It's disconcerting that it seems like a lot of standard practice policies would be based off of what looks to be like a decades old study that seemed flimsy at best in terms of adjusting someone's calculations as to like whether or not they need a certain specialist referral or a medication or a treatment. I would think really make sure that the science behind that makes sense and is current and is like stays current and peer reviewed. And so it's just totally, it's disconcerting to me that it seems like this seems like yet another piece of evidence that's woven into the fabric of systemic oppression of Black people, where they, you know, it's prejudicial healthcare injustice built right into empirical tests where there are corrections based on your race that dictate your healthcare treatment. There has got to be a better way. This article and these questions come up at a time when the Black community is disproportionately already affected by COVID. And we've spoken at length about the health disparities generally for Black women in childbirth. And I believe Black women are 4 to 5 times more likely to die in childbirth than a white woman. And a white woman with less than a high school degree receives better care than Black women with PhDs. So the data in that study takes into account different socioeconomic stuff. So it's just really, really disconcerting. From the New York Times article, quote, despite mounting evidence that race is not a reliable proxy for genetic difference, the belief that it has become embedded, sometimes insidiously, within the medical practice still happens. The paper is being published. I pulled a few quotes. Some of the tools specifically where outcomes are affected include osteoporosis risk calculators that are endorsed by the National Osteoporosis Foundation, which calculates chances of a fracture differently for Black and white women. Black women end up having a score that makes it less likely that they would be prescribed osteoporosis medication than white women who are similar in other respects. Labs are routinely used for kidney function calculators that adjust filtration rates for Black patients. And with the adjustment, Black patients end up with slightly better rates than white patients, which can make people who have a borderline rate ineligible to be on a kidney transplant list. So there's just a lot of really disconcerting data. And one thing that I found hopeful was that a couple of years ago, medical student in the article, New York Times reports that medical students at Harvard, after having like some sociology classes where they were like, isn't race actually just a social construct from what we learned? They took it to Beth Israel, and Beth Israel in Boston made changes to their policies, but to date, no other major institutions have modified their policies. So this one's just super weird, something to look out for. Not a good look for the medical community in 2020. We see you.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
All right. 8 correctional officers working at the jail that held Derek Chauvin have filed a discrimination lawsuit saying that only white employees were allowed to guard him. Derek Chauvin is the cop who killed George Floyd. Apparently, officers of color were ordered to a separate floor when he arrived, and a supervisor told them that their race made them potential liabilities. One sergeant said, "I understood that the decision to segregate us has been made because we could not be trusted to carry out our work responsibilities professionally around the high-profile inmates solely because of the color of our skin. I am not aware of a similar situation where white officers were segregated from an inmate."
Yeah.
I'm not either. A spokesman for the jail said he decided to keep employees of color away because having people of color interact with him could have heightened ongoing trauma.
Huh.
Okay. Sure, dude. Steve.
Steve.
And apparently, a white lieutenant who was allowed around Chauvin allowed him to use a cell phone in his cell, which is a violation of the policy there. So they're banning officers of color from guarding him, and the officers that are guarding him are giving him special treatment, and he literally just murdered somebody. Like, okay. But yeah, white privilege, not a thing. Totally. We see you.
We see you. This last one is just to keep a lookout for what happens in a recent case in LA where an 18-year-old, Andre Guardado, was shot by a sheriff's deputy in Gardena, California. The police are saying that he, quote, produced a firearm and ran away from the two deputies. And it's unclear because there weren't the body cameras weren't on, like, what happened with this confrontation. But this 18-year-old was a security guard, so he was armed as a part of his job as a security guard. And I mean, I would assume running away from cops is like kind of a natural thing these days. And maybe he was spooked. We don't know. It just seems like a sketchy situation. Mr. Guardado was working two jobs. He was working his security guard job and was also studying to be a mechanic at LA Trade Technical College. And yeah, he was killed near where he was providing security. So again, like, don't have all the facts in this, and I certainly am gonna, but I'll just be watching to see kind of what the facts are. It just feels like another situation where, you know, the cops just shoot someone down. And if this person was armed for their job, I can only imagine kind of the fear that others, you know, who are armed for their job, like other people of color armed for their job, how they would feel, you know, because it just feels like you're never safe. Even when you're armed, you're not safe. In fact, you're even maybe less safe. I don't know, but it's not a fun thing to think about. It's just like, it's depressing. And I think his family definitely deserves answers. And, if there are updates, I'll try to bring it to the, try to remember to bring it to the pod.
Yes.
So we that. See you.
Alrighty. For a good thing. Yay. So there are various nonprofits that exist to provide bail money for low-income people who are in jail or immigration detention, who are believed to be like wrongfully incarcerated and can't afford to get out. And the good news is that in the past few weeks, the surge of donations has led some groups to be in completely different financial situations than they were before in a real long-term way. Like one place, Minnesota Freedom Fund, in 2018, they had about $150,000. In the past few weeks, they've received $31 million for more than 900,000 donations.
I love it.
So that is very, very significant in terms of the lives that are going to be, you know, positively impacted and the people who can be helped with that. so yeah, look into some maybe in your area, if there's a nonprofit set up doing the same work, because this is going to make like an actual real difference. Mm-hmm. So yay.
Yay. That's so good. That's so good. Yeah. There are positive things happening. And we've got to celebrate those wins. Definitely all these groups getting some long-term funding and feeling like they're more supported. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of positive Supreme Court cases swing our way. So that's good. However, still super cautious about giving the conservative court too many accolades, but in these cases, you just have to celebrate the wins. Yeah. So those are good. Mm-hmm. We've just got to kind of hang in there and
keep fighting the fight, doing the thing.
Yeah.
Alrighty. Well, hopefully all these primaries go swimmingly.
Yes. Fingers crossed.
I almost said love you. Love you guys.
Love you.